Welcome to your podcast for this week. And today I'd like to introduce you to Eshelle Ozep.
Hello, Geraldine. Thank you for having me. Hello to the viewers.
Thank you for being here. So, reason being why I thought it would be very great for people to get to know you is we are here co-pandem, and you also have undergone certain transformation in past months or years.
Yes.
Would you just give us a little bit of your background and what is it that you did?
Yes. So my name is Eshel Ozer. I come from Israel. I'm 35 years old. And now I come from a farming business family. So I spent a lot of time in my life in that field. And I'm also a writer. And I also work with people for their writing projects, with their creativity, with creating all sorts of books, videos, and whatever is like involves the creative process. So I work with people creative processes, and I done a lot of work with cannabis addiction. I have a book about the relationship with cannabis. It's a book in Hebrew. It's called By Personal Choice, Healing the Relationship with Cannabis.
Okay.
And I was working with people in that fields of addiction and mental breakdowns, panic attacks. And this is more or less the fields that I was interested in.
Okay, so this is interesting. Your background is actually farming. So your family has its own business.
Yes.
And you also have been working on that farm.
Yes.
Okay. And then when did you start writing?
I started writing. I think that I was always into reading as a child. And the first time I noticed, like during when I was a teenager, so I had a few instances where I had like a full night of writing. I got like inspired and suddenly I started writing and it didn't continue after. And when I was 21, like close to the end of my military service in Israel, so I was at home and again, I had this night of writing. Nowadays, I call it like when inspiration is getting out. And after that night, so I posted it on Facebook. It was about 2009 or 10. And now I know that I belong to like a generation of Facebook writers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. During the first years of Facebook, the media that was presented there was writing. And there are a lot of people who are today famous writers that started out in that times writing on Facebook.
I remember that.
So as soon as I published something that I wrote and I got people commenting and reacting with me, so that's where my writing journey began.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what was your first book that you wrote with that?
My first book, I published it when I was 27. It's called, in Hebrew, it's the translation, it's called Life from the Side. This book, it's, I wanted to write a book that would describe like the life and thoughts and feelings of a person in Israel that is finishing his army service and going out to life. Because I felt that in this space, there is a big confusion and something interesting is happening there. And I wanted to document it for so that some days someone could look at it and like see the...
How was it for you?
This getting out of the army in the military service? At first you are very happy because you have freedom and you can do whatever you want and you're not confined to this system. Then you start seeing that some things you learned are not relevant to what you have to do in life and you start adjusting yourself and sometimes it's a painful process.
And you have chosen, you're not anymore in the military service.
I'm not anymore in the military service. In Israel, there is a reserve duty, basically, but most people don't know that basically it's up to you.
It's up to you.
Basically, it's up to you. You can always say that you don't really want to do it or you make up some doctor's excuse and you're out.
Okay.
Yeah. So for me, at a certain point, I decided that this system is not for me.
Yeah.
I don't like to be a very small part of a very big system, that I have too much knowledge about the goings of politics and all that. So for people who have to function inside that system, once you have a certain mindset, it's conflicting.
Absolutely. Okay. So what happened after your first book? Then you mentioned you wrote a book about cannabis. So tell us about your journey when it comes to drugs, addictions. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So when I was off the army, at first I was working in the family business and I was starting to manage the family business because a key manager that we have has died in a very sudden way. And I had to take his place and teach other people to do his job. And they did that for a year. And then, like a lot of Israelis do after the military service, I went traveling, and I went traveling in Asia. I was smoking a lot of cannabis at the time. And I was also experimenting with other drugs, such as the LSD. After half a year, I went back to Israel. Again, I was working in the business, and I had on the one hand, I was a very young person, very unestablished personality. On the other hand, I had a big role, a big job, a lot of responsibility, and not a lot of awareness and not a lot of the coping skills with this sort of environment. And in December 2013, I went to a trans party.
Yeah.
And I used LSD. And now I know, after a lot of years looking back at it, so I know that there is such a thing as that is called drug setting.
Okay.
Which is a model for analyzing the experiences you get when you use psychedelic drugs, or basically in any situation.
Yes.
So now I know that when I came to that situation, I was very sad at those days, and I started having panic attacks that I didn't know about, and I had no awareness of what it is. And I was very tired, and I mixed it with alcohol and cannabis. Mm. At some point during this party, so I was looking at the view, and I got this frightening thought that reality isn't real. Which, if you think about it in a very spiritual way, when you are prepared, maybe it could be a beautiful thing. But when you're very young and you're getting this kind of realization in a very unhinged way, so it's very frightening. And immediately I felt in my body a feeling of disconnection from the body. And I went looking for help. And when I went looking for help, I couldn't find any help. I couldn't find my friends. The party was an illegal party, so the organizers didn't have anything to do for any. The security was just there pushing me away. And it was a very, in addition to that experience that I had with myself, so I had a secondary experience of not getting the help I need.
Jeez.
So... And in that, in addition to that, okay, I said set and setting. So set, it means what you bring with yourself. And setting, it's the environment. And the environment, it includes the society and your own environment view on a certain thing that happens.
Yeah.
So in that time in society, looking at this kind of events, it was that people are flipping out. People are losing their mind in we using psychedelic drugs in parties such as this. So immediately my mind started to tell me, it happened to you. You're flicking out. You lost your life. You are very, you did something that is unrepairable. And all of these things started to come about. And I went home and I told my parents. And they were supportive, but they didn't have any tools or knowledge of this, but I did turn to some professional help, yet I did have the big privilege of getting like good professional help from a psychologist, Chinese medicine,
nice,
psychiatry.
So you had a whole turnaround, not only one tool.
No, I immediately when it happened, so I understood that I have to commit myself to this healing because I knew that I have nothing else in life. Everything in life moves aside when this kind of experience happens. And a week later, I had another episode.
Did you take something or was it still in your system?
No, it wasn't due to drugs. It was a panic attack. It was basically an anxiety attack.
Yes.
And with some, you know, psychedelic memory.
Yes.
And once it happened the second time, then the real panic began. Because, okay, the first time I used drugs, I will not use drugs again, so it won't happen to me. But then when it happens again and you don't have any trigger that you can control, so you start having what is called an anxiety disorder.
Yes.
Which means you are fearing fear.
Yes.
And then you get in a loop of all the time your stress levels are very high.
Fight-flight mode.
Fight or flight mode. And for me, it really manifested in this thing that is called derealization or depersonalization.
Wow, and it's illusion.
It's not so much of an illusion. It's like I used to see everything very clearly. I used to be very much in reality. But because of like overflooding with stress, I had a disconnect from my feelings and emotion to the things that are happening. So I was very much sane. I would look okay from the outside. I would act. I would know how to act normally. But my emotional disconnection was very total.
So you were not connected within yourself with your emotions because they were just blocked. There was a disconnection.
There was only stress and panic.
Wow.
And I became very sensitive. I got into this very heightened sensitivity mode that I used to feel the smallest trembles. Like if I was inside of a house, I could know if there are people in the house. And I used to, like, at first I was, because of all this overflooding, so I couldn't, of course, I couldn't use any drugs. I couldn't drink alcohol, but I could also not listen to music. I could also not be in too much of crowded places. Any overstimulation caused a panic attack. Now, I started seeing a psychologist, and this psychologist, he gave me a book. This book is called Feeling Good by David Burns. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most famous CBT books. And I started working immediately when he gave it to me.
What's the CBT?
CBT is a psychological method that is called a cognitive behavioral treatment.
There we go. Yes.
The basis of CBT is that you perceive reality, and then you, let's say, you analyze reality through your thought. Your thought is like one of the tools that you use to analyze reality, and after your thought, you get like an emotional,
yes,
reaction. And this emotional reaction, it creates your behavior, and then your behavior, it creates again your, what you get back.
Feedback.
The feedback that again is filtered through thoughts. And this is the basic, this is the basic idea of cognitive behavioral treatment. And the treatment is based basically on a list of 10 cognitive mistakes. Okay, we have certain thoughts that are automatic thoughts that we, as humans, we are very prone to jump into these thoughts. For example, all or nothing thinking.
Yeah.
For example, emotional filtering, emotional thinking. Okay, if we feel a certain emotion, it covers our entire world. And we think it's like that in past, in future. So for a long while, I had a little notebook where I used to write my ever-ending thoughts at that time. Because also, now I know that when you are flooded, when you are emotionally flooded, So our mind is also like an output.
Yeah.
It's an output. So you get all this output all the time, and it's very unpleasant. It almost hurts. But in a way, it's an opportunity to do like mindfulness.
Absolutely.
And to know your thought patterns. And I started analyzing. I had like I used to like analyze my thought patterns using this method of just doing intuitive writing, and then analyzing through the CBT method by the like thought mistake. And when you do it for a long time, so your mind starts working in a very accurate way. Because those cognitive mistakes, cognitive errors, it's not a matter of opinion. You know, it's not a matter of you should think this way or that way. It's a matter of pure logic where you can have small, it's like code. It's like code. When you have a small bug that is reoccurring, it will collapse the software. So that was like the main tool that I used in my healing process alongside physical activity and Chinese medicine.
And what did you do with Chinese medicine? Was this like cupping and acupuncture?
It was acupuncture, and I used to go to a special a therapist in Tel Aviv with a known therapist. And I used to get like acupuncture. I can say that I had like, you know, three main figures. I did a lot of things during that time. I did also Qigong. I did a lot of things during that time. But I had like three mentors. Like one was the psychiatrist, one was the psychologist, and one was the Chinese doctor. And I can say the Chinese doctor, he's the one that could really tell me about the process, about what is going to happen to me. He had the most confidence that people from Western medicine, usually they, you know, they have to use disclaimers. They can't tell you anything because they are afraid of insurance reasons, that if we tell something wrong, so they don't use intuitive in any way. But he could also, like, it was like, you know, for me, it was passive, but it initiated all sorts of healings in my body.
So it changed actually he worked with your meridians, changed the chi flow, the energy flow. Yeah, because there's a stagnation. And this is interesting because this shows like a really multidimensional approach on doing this. That it's not only here, it's also the physical, energetically. And what about spiritual? You're really secular.
I think that all these things are eventually... I came from a very secular background, so it was very frightening to me to turn to spiritual practices, because you are always afraid as a secular person that they would, that like the religion would catch you in a weak moment and get you inside of their circles. And for me, it was like a lot of, you know, learning how to endure this pain. Also, I know today that it didn't happen now out of thin air. Okay. At that time, it was very good and comforting to me to use this explanation of panic attacks. You know, this is a very simple thing that does not, it's sort of a technical failure. And you don't start looking at all the things that happened to you and led you to that place. But once I had perspective and here's done by, and I was looking at it from the future. So I knew, okay, I was a young person that endured a very intense military service. Then I had like a very stressful job that was, you know, like that is meant for much older people than I had. And I had a lot of personal like insufficiencies, you know, like social, romantic, whatever, personal growth wise. And all of this background led to this moment.
Yeah.
that for the first time in my life sent me to get help. So, and it made me like start a journey that writing was also a big part of.
Yes.
Because when you have trauma, especially when you have trauma from a certain event, because what happened to me is like very classic PTSD that is oriented for a certain one big event that causes the entire field of triggers. I mean, what happens is that I had a very stressful emotional moment in a certain environment. That environment included certain music, it included certain people, it included certain thoughts. It included a lot of things. Those things later were triggers for my body, for it to stay away from. But because it was an exaggerated, imaginary thing, so your entire field of consciousness become blocked by triggers.
Yeah.
And then like the work is getting close to those triggers, getting inside those triggers, and explaining to the body that you can return and nothing happens. So writing is a wonderful tool for that. And it took me a few months, almost half a year, to be able to write the experience of what happened to me. Because with writing, you know, I would start writing and then I would get some sort of panic attack and I had to stop. But eventually I wrote an entire diary about...
So it was a healing journey.
It was a very much of a healing journey, and I wrote an entire diary and I had to slowly deactivate the anxiety triggers using writing to do that. And about a year and a half later, I was already feeling much better, but still I had a lot of insecurities and triggers. And one of them was about cannabis, because mm-hmm. for me, I moved from a situation where cannabis was a huge part of my life.
Yes.
To a situation where it was a danger to my life and I didn't use it at all. And I didn't want to have this fear also. It's tricky. You get certain triggers that are in a way harmful to you, but it's also harmful to you to have the trigger.
Yeah, if you know how to deal with it, it's a protection filter, but it can still be helpful for yourself. Yeah.
So at one point, I was with some people and I smoked cannabis. And I didn't have a panic attack.
Good.
So after I went home that day, so I was thinking to myself, like, what are you doing? You are returning to a habit that brought you to a very bad place.
Yes.
And then I started writing on my computer or in a notebook, I don't remember. And then suddenly a lot of things came together for me. Because I was a writer, because I had this healing journey and with this vulnerability, so I could really notice very small shifts and patterns. And with the CBT practice, so I started writing manual for people that are cannabis users to get off weed for a month.
Wow. Okay, so you shared actually your experience.
Yeah, first I wanted to write it for myself, just so I would like not return to the bad habits and that I would understand what happened to me and what is the journey that I went through. But eventually I started showing it to people and people were like, wow, you wrote like an entire self-help manual. And what was special about it is we're talking about the year 2015, approximately.
It's 10 years.
And 10 years ago, it was still, cannabis was not legalized almost anywhere. And for cannabis users at that time, to say something about quitting smoking, you are between a hammer and a hard place. Because from one hand, you had like the establishment, also the medical establishment, also the psychological establishment that is looking at cannabis users as criminals, as people who the police is the one to take care of. And on the other hand, you have your friends that are very protective of the cannabis because they are in a legalization movement. And they are protecting their right, and their justified right, by the way, to not be punished and persecuted for the consumption of a natural plant. And so what I did is I got in the middle of this. And I told people, listen, this is not about disliking cannabis. This is not about cannabis is bad. This is about you wanting to have the best feeling you can have and take care of yourself. So I started this method from the question, I want to start to stop smoking, but I started from the answers to, I don't remember how it's called.
It's similar to say, like, one of the drugs that we have in our society, I want to stop drinking, but...
Yes. So in every, it's true to every addiction. I want to stop using social media, but I want to stop having toxic relationships, but... Okay. And it's always the same buts. Okay. It's always the same things. I would be depressed without it. I would be sad about it.
I would be alone.
I would be alone. It helped me socially. I don't want to become what people tell me to be. It's a certain group of this, wait, I don't remember the word. It's called resistance.
Yes.
It's certain like frames of resistance that are always the same. And once you, and what I seen is, so I started from this place. I started from a point of the phase of getting ready to stop. Okay. And my theory is, and in my book, I made it into an equation. I said, like, once you get ready to stop, so at one point, once you are ready, you will get a special enchanted moment of decision.
Absolutely. It's a pivot moment. Yeah.
And in that moment of decision, if you are ready, you could take this decision and you could make the process.
Yes.
And once you start the process, so the first days, the first week have a certain dynamics. That is a dynamics of like just avoiding this certain behavior that you're trying to stop.
Meaning avoiding to see the group of people, the places,
yeah, I have,
surroundings.
I have a modality that is called strength and that is about strength and temptation.
Yes.
It's based on a phase. It's one of those internet phrases that is not really attributed to the person, but it's in the internet, it's a tribute to Henry David Thoreau, American poet.
Yes.
So the phrase is, we get the strength from the temptations we resist.
Absolutely.
And what happens is you start off with very low strength and very high temptations. Okay. So. And people, you know, in recovery, in drugs recovery, sometimes they tell people, you know, change your friends, change your environment. But I think this is not fair towards people in a way, because it's as if making friends is very easy and very, people are not able to change their entire environments.
Not necessary, no.
Sometimes they can.
Yeah.
But not always, and not all people want it, and not all people have the same severity of problems. And what I'm saying is that, but you do have to understand that in the first time, like when you start getting off a certain habit that became an addiction for you, and you said we want to talk about what is an addiction, so mm-hmm. Maybe we could do it soon. So you need to be more avoidant of temptation situations.
It is easier if you take these temptation situations out of the equation. Yeah.
At first you can do it, and for a limited yes. time, but the world is full of temptations. Okay, some people are addicted to things that they can't avoid.
No, you can't. If this is really your mobile phone, social media, or even your partner that is like it's pretty much like the neediness, attachment. Any of these are addictions.
Yeah. So the thing is that for a certain, to build up your strength, you need to have a contained environment of how do you call it when you two people approach each other, not a fight.
Of mutual.
You need to have like contained meetings of this thing, and once you so you can isolate certain events where you meet the temptation.
Yeah.
And then in this event, if you meet the temptation in a regulated way. So you can say, okay, I'm bringing there certain things that can help you. You could have like a guardian angel,
yes.
Person that comes with you. You could tell the people ahead.
Yes.
In cannabis, I used to tell people it's very easy to refrain from using cannabis if you're in a different place where cannabis is. It's harder if cannabis is in the room. It's becoming harder if somebody lights a joint, and it becomes really hard if you're in that situation. So you need to get the temptation as far from you as you can.
Yes.
And with time, as your strength gets bigger, you can get into more and more spaces, like we talked before about the triggers. Okay, because we are trying eventually to expand our world. We are trying to empower people to live a life.
Yes. And not be... You want to be free. You don't want to be like the slave to that temptation. I remember very much when I used to be really into coke. When I would go to a party, I would beg for that person who would potentially be able to give me some. But it was like really like the drive. But if you stay away from these places, I had to change countries and I had to leave.
Yes.
I needed that. Because I was not strong at that time to resist the temptation.
Sometimes you're inside a certain environment in which the temptation is too strong for you to start a change.
Absolutely.
Once you change, once you go to a safe space, you need to gradually become like able to resist yourself, or to even not, at some point you don't want these kind of things if you do a long journey of recovery. So you don't want these things?
No, you don't want necessary partner who's involved in it, because it's really hard if your own partner is involved with it.
Of course, you're not you're not inviting problems into your life after you define them as problems.
No, because that is not going to be helping you in a healing journey. You do need to change that environment. Yeah.
So this is like the first modality. And the second thing is, I call it when smoke is... a reconnection, because with cannabis is a very wide array substance. It could help you cope with sadness, anxiety, loneliness, social situations, pain, all sorts of issues. And once you tear down the veil of smoke, you start seeing what it did for you. Usually there is a connectivity between this, when you start to have like, I want to stop, but between your buts and the things that you eventually realize that this is what cannabis did for you.
Yeah.
And once you discover those things, okay, so certain needs arise.
Yeah.
Certain desires arise. Certain pains arise. And then you have to work with this.
That's actually where the healing journey really starts.
Yes. Yes. So quitting cannabis for many people is the start of a healing journey.
Yeah.
Because usually cannabis helps people in the first stage of coping with a certain trauma. It helps relieve the pain. It helps continue living. It helps them with the first stage.
Yes.
This is why cannabis is given to a lot of PTSD patients. Because it helps you be in the moment and be contained from everything. But in long-term use, it might get you disconnected. And The reason why this, the reason why my method and my book is about the relationship with cannabis is because I don't, like, I differ from the approach of, you know, 12 steps recovery that rejects a certain essence for good. And the way I see it, it could be a part of a person's lifestyle, but you should have a good relationship with it. If your relationship is always toxic, a good relationship would be disconnection.
Absolutely. I mean, this is with everything this way. What is the relationship to your own body? What is the relationship to food, to your partner? Yeah, everything can.
And this comes from an approach that is called the harm reduction, which is a certain approach that came from social workers. And it's basically a substitute for the war on drugs approach that preceded it. And because it focuses on the person rather on the substance. And yeah, so my book is approaching cannabis use from that angle.
Thank you for sharing that. So that is because it's obviously legal and you can smell it anywhere in the world. Like if you go to New York, if you go here in Copanan.
Yeah, in many places, not everywhere. I would say that like when you get into it, okay, you understand also something about cannabis is a symbol. Is a symbol for many cultures, for many people, of because many problems come from the decriminalization of cannabis. Yeah. Okay, here in Thailand, it was only criminalized in the 80s, and they didn't used to use the flowers for smoking so much. Mm. They used to cook the leaves. Mm. Okay, it was a part of the culture. But once they criminalized it, so they also bring about the legalization activity. And then once they legalize or medicalize, okay, so nowadays in the world, there is cannabis that is much stronger, like engineered in a way to be very potent.
Okay.
And when, yeah, and some and people who are aware of this history and of this, what happened with the cannabis and the other illegal drugs, the 20th century on, it's also something to consider within that space.
Wow, okay, so I've not been experienced with this part of cannabis. So what, this is not any medical advice or any professional advice, like in a sense of like therapeutic advice. This is just to share with you how your story, because you have lived it. And what is always a very important for me to meet practitioners, coaches, or people who actually experience it themselves. Because frankly speaking, it's very easy for a coach. I don't think it's easy actually for a coach to coach someone who has never experienced how it is to have an addiction. I find it actually like, I know how it is to have an addiction. So for me, I understand that point of view, but if I would not know, how would I be able to hold space for this person?
I think nowadays, so addiction became a phenomenon that almost everybody experienced.
Absolutely.
In certain ways. Because what is addiction? Okay, like every habit, like from a certain angle of view, any habit could be viewed as an addiction. But what I think is that addiction is the situation where you are suffering from something, where you want to stop doing something, but you have this internal conflict that you are not able to have control over your own behavior. And you are, in a way, damaging yourself and you have this conflict. I think this conflict is the addiction.
The conflict is the addiction to actually escape. That stimulus responding, reacting to that stimulus, like there's a difficult situation I have to deal with. It's easier for me to smoke a joint now.
Yeah.
Instead of actually looking at this difficult
situation. Yeah, as while I smoke a joint, so I have the awareness.
Yes.
that it's hurting me.
Yes.
Or, I have the awareness that it's hurting me and I have a conflict that I say, okay, I want to stop smoking, but maybe I'll smoke another joint. And then it starts going down on yourself.
Yes.
So this is the sign of addiction. This is what I consider addiction, because there was a lot of discourse in the 90s and the 2000s about the difference between a physical addiction and a mental addiction.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, not relevant, because what is mental, not physical?
Yes.
You know what I mean? So
it's a disconnection between all the layers. It's mental, not physical, because it all influences all these different layers. Yeah.
All of the mental activity is wired in the brain and the body.
Yeah.
So everything is physical and everything is also mental.
Yeah.
So you have to define addiction from a point of view of the experience that a person is experiencing.
Yeah.
So if you start looking for all these medical signs, so you'll get a million different. This is how I see it.
Yeah. So that last week we spoke for our family Hippocampus, which is the nonprofit organization initiative that we open up, and we work with family members. And there's a lot of the next generation that has these addictions, and there are very great clinics, fancy clinics. But I like your approach, how you went through it, because I also did not go to rehab. I actually replaced that coke addiction with alcohol, which was not great. But it is this healing journey of like, what is it? Why am I doing this? Why is this happening?
I have a good friend, and this is very relevant to this topic. I have a good friend that had some problems, and they took her to like these fancy rehab centers and all that. And it didn't really help her. And what helped her is that the family went to family consultant together.
There we go.
Okay. And eventually, in many cases, okay, it's very easy to scapegoat a certain person inside of a group, inside of a dynamic. And it's very easy also to scapegoat a certain behavior.
Yes.
Okay. Like this person drug use is the problem of this person and of the entire family and of the entire society and all that. And in many cases, this is not the case. In many cases, people, I'm not talking about people that feel themselves that they have a problem, and a lot of times, like, because people are scapegoating our behavior, so we feel that we don't, it makes us be resistant. It makes us resist taking care of ourselves. So I'm not saying about that, but in many cases, people just want to look at a certain thing that is frowned upon in society.
Yes.
Like certain drug use.
Yes.
And avoid looking at different communications and work problems and that has to do with an entire group of other people. So I think in my story, when I had a very big break, this big breakdown, my family gave me the best. I was very lucky and very privileged to have the ability to get good therapist, or of course a place to like security for a place to live, for money, for everything. And I got this in the community, because this is the best, usually, not always it's possible, but when it's possible, the best approach is to stay inside the community, because you get acquainted with the place that you are already living, and you learn to solve your problems inside your environment. When you're being put in a closed environment, so you also have the integration into
society
back again. But in certain situations, it's also good to get out of. I mean, those things are always depends on and
it's
anything.
Not one fixed approach.
Yeah, it depends on many things, but yeah, but usually you have to look at the system.
Yes.
Good. Well, thank you so much for everything that you shared, and it's quite a journey. And I know there's more books and poems you're going to write, and I don't think this is the last time I'm going to speak.
Yes.
So thank you for sharing it from a different perspective, because we can hear from a therapeutic way all, you know, there's a lot online on social media, but actually from someone who has lived it and has gone through it, it's a difference.
Yes, and I didn't even mention it, but I also worked with, and interacted with thousands of people about it.
Yeah.
So it's not only my experience.
Nope.
I'm sure.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
So thanks. I'll be going to meet Eshel another time, and yeah, I'll see you next week.
Welcome. My name is Geraldine Hardy, and I'd like to introduce you today to Alina, the sanctuary. Alina is a concept that can be implemented in any existing property, a resort or hotel, a clinic or well-being center. We're going to combine longevity technology that you can find in stem cell therapy, infusions, peptides, and longevity technology machines with the ancient practices, including traditional Chinese medicine, yoga, Ayurveda, energy and frequency medicine, naturopathy, and homeopathy. These tools will be combined and formed into an individual protocol, customized and personalized to the patient, to create a deep, profound healing journey. I'd like to share with you my journey. About 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with a benign tumor in my left breast. My autoimmune disorder also came back. I knew I had to really embrace profound change and transformation. So I worked on my physical layer with the longevity technology, but on my emotional and mental layer, I had to change my belief systems. So I used traditional Chinese medicine, yoga and Ayurveda, movement practices, energy healing and quantum healing techniques, as well as past life regression sessions to be able to release my trauma, my emotional wounding that was the root cause of my diseases at the first place. And I thought to myself, if I can do this, everyone can do this. We see these days a lot of longevity technology coming up. It is almost a $7 trillion industry. What we are missing is really, how do you heal the emotional wounding, the trauma? And this is pretty much the root cause of any disease. With all of our partners at Alina the Sanctuary, we are creating protocols that will be individualized and customized to the patient's needs. Please join us on this journey that will be able to expand in growth immensely, and we are able to take the franchise to various different properties in the world. We have a light asset model, so we are offering the concept, not directly a property, nor do we lease a property or acquire an asset. This has been done deliberately that keeps us being able to move fast in the market at the moment, and be able to implement the concept easily and existing structures without having to renovate, to acquire an asset, or have any delays in building something. We are seeking $500,000 to $750,000 that will actually include the marketing, the branding, the most important part, creation of the protocols, bringing in together all the facilitators, creating a membership model that will be useful for each of the facilities where we implement the concept, and being able to create extra value in any of the given entities that need some extra help with consultancy. So please have a look at the deck. It's very straightforward. We are asset light. And maybe we're going to have a Series A, but for now, we're going to try to create revenue and generate revenue with existing clients that we're working or speaking and collaborating with at the moment. Thank you for your time. My name is Geraldine Hardy. You can reach me on Geraldine@GeraldineHardy.com. Thank you.